Please join me, Donna Bear Stein, in welcoming tonight's very special Tefera Talk Show guest, award-winning poet, editor, translator, and critic, Aliki Barnstone. Aliki is a brilliant, sensitive, and prolific author and creative writing professor at the University of Missouri at Columbia. Her work has received 2 Pulitzer Prize nominations and recognition from the National Book Critics Circle. She has published 7 books of poetry, including Bright Body, Blue Earth, Wild With It, Madly in Love, Windows in Providence, The Real Tin Flower, and Dear God, Dr. Heartbreak, New and Selected Poems. Other publications include Changing Rapture, Emily Dickinson's Poetic Development from the University Press of New England, and The Collected Poems of C.P. Kafafi, A New Translation from Norton. In addition, Aliki edited A Book of Women Poets from Antiquity to Now, The Calvinist Roots of the Modern Era, and Voices of Light, Spiritual and Visionary Poetry by Women from Ancient Sumeria to Now. Aliki's poems and translations have appeared in numerous publications, including the American Poetry Review, the Georgia Review, New Letters, Tri-Quarterly Review, and many others. It is truly an honor to welcome this impressively multi-talented author, Aliki Barnstone.
Aliki, hi.
Hi.
Thank you. I want to thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I have so enjoyed reading some of your books and poems. They have been perfect in these difficult days with challenges in the world, and they've just been beautiful. Carolyn Kaiser noted your radiant intelligence, and I think that's just a perfect description of your talent. I'd like to start our talk tonight, if you would, by telling our listeners a bit about the fertile landscape in which such radiant intelligence took root, your childhood that came before your very impressive career.
My father is a poet, translator, literary critic, editor, and every summer, and my mother is a painter, and so every summer we used to go to Vermont, and we lived 20 minutes away from Ruth Stone and her daughters, and we used to all get together and play the poetry game, and so from the very youngest person to the oldest person, everybody was writing together and reading out loud, and my mother would not allow any television or phone or anything, so we were in this isolated place in Vermont, which is actually, I just visited, and it's still kind of the same. I mean, there's been a few houses, so we used our imaginations and played made-up plays and played in the fields and drew and read and wrote, and as a result of that, those summers in Vermont, I can never be bored because my mind can always take me someplace interesting, even if it's awful circumstances.
That's wonderful. That's such a gift. And I know your book, Madly in Love, begins with a poem in which a man goes to visit Ruth Stone, correct?
Yes, yeah. That was one of those legendary stories. This man who had, I guess, been a boyfriend or of my mom's, fell in love with Ruth. And in the poem, he arrives at her door. He breaks into her house, holding his, naked, and lies down on the floor and screams. And then he walks over the Brandon Gap in his underwear and knocks on our door, which is a very long walk from her place to our place. at any rate, I say that I don't like to admit that things in my poems really happened, you know, kind of literally happened. But that one really did happen.
And I'm not sure if you mentioned your dad's name, but I'll just make
Willis
sure it's
Barnstone.
In here, Willis Barnstone. And you also have a poet brother, Tony Barnstone, and
that's correct.
Other brother who's a sculptor, is that correct?
My other brother, Robert, is a sculptor and architect, and he lives in Australia. And my mom is a painter, mm-hmm. a marvelous painter. So I was raised in a, I mean, I don't want to make it sound like it was heaven, because it certainly wasn't, but it certainly was blessed in many ways. And my parents, their flaws that everyone has, always encouraged us. And in the
yeah.
end, I think that that being encouraged, having people that have faith in you, makes up for other things.
Yes, that's so true. So true. And so your first book, you published your first book when you were 12, I believe, with Macmillan. How did that come about, and how did you feel when you held that book in your hands?
I don't remember holding the book in my hand. It's just a kind of interesting thought, because I remember holding a lot of my other books in my hand
uh-huh.
when they first arrived. My dad tells the story that I was more concerned with the fact that my father was buying my brother a bicycle. I was 12.
Right, right.
But it came about because my father took my manuscript to New York and gave it to a publisher, Macmillan, and the editor looked at it and said, Willis, we should give up, or something like that. I feel uncomfortable bragging on myself. And so they published it, and then Anne Sexton wrote the introduction. I never
Wonderful.
Met her.
You, I was going to ask, you had not met her?
I never met her, no.
So the radiant intelligence showed through at a very early age. That's wonderful.
I think that most children begin like that.
Mm-hmm. And as long as
everyone,
you aren't in it. Yeah.
I think that, I mean, I don't want to diminish my own, I don't believe in, you know, that some people are, you know, way above other people. I don't want to diminish my gift, because it is a gift. But I think everyone has gifts, and one of my sorrows in this world is that so many children are not encouraged and live in horrifying conditions, and that even here, where everyone should have a great education beginning from preschool on, they don't. And
yes.
that spirit of exploration, which can take you so far, no matter what your interest is squashed.
Yes, and that's a tragedy.
Yeah.
And that actually leads me into another question that I had put together for you, that in the blurb on the back, one of the blurbs on the back of Madly in Love, Robert Pinsky writes, "Pleasure, wonder, anger, and moral passion are here." And in the post of yours that I've seen on Facebook, your moral passion is evident daily. Whether it's moral outrage or sorrow at events that are taking place around the world, this is obviously a really important part of your life in addition to your writing. There's another line from your poem, Psychology, "I could scream my fury until the sky thundered," which I love. And I'm wondering how you see either the act of writing or the act of reading what's been written as fitting into or even ameliorating the suffering that does exist in the world.
In every oppressive regime, the artists are the ones who are the first to go, be silenced, put in jail, executed, have to go into exile, and so on. And so I think that the act of writing and the act of making art allows people to enter a realm in which the purest of humanity's psyche and aspirations is present, experienced. And I think that that's a very dangerous thing. There's a reason why it was a crime to teach a slave to read, for example. So I don't feel that I can change the world, but I feel like I can do my little part. When Pete Seeger died, it was totally devastating to me. And he said that it's not going to be, you know, big actions. It's going to be millions of small actions. And he had an image of a teeter-totter where there's a basket full of stones, big, heavy stones. And then on the other end is a basket with that where the sand can seep out, but people keep on putting teaspoonfuls of sand into the basket. And eventually the basket is heavier than those big stones.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And each poem written, each post that's written is something that helps that weight.
And everybody joins together. I mean, Facebook is such a strange, the rest of the social media leaves me, I can't do all of it. I can't learn it all. I Twitter occasionally, but I don't get it. I don't understand how to do it. But I think that it's fascinating the ways in which people can connect and get upset, too, and have to drop out of it all for a while. And on the one hand, I think that there's such a kind of storm all the time of information and, you know, silly, wonderful pet videos and you know, people who post things that are so horrifying that I have to block them. Not because,
yeah.
You know, but at the same time, I think that there is great possibility in all of us having the potential all over the world to be connected at the same time.
Yes, I agree, yep.
And I don't think that we've yet comprehended what this revolution has done to our psyches, and it is a revolution. I mean, I can't write anymore without the internet because I'm constantly looking things up,
mm-hmm.
looking up definitions of words, looking up etymology, looking up history. My next book is tentatively entitled, I say tentatively because every time I write a book, I change the title a few times, and ecos, which means house in Greek and is also the root of ecology, ecumenical, and so on, economy. And so I didn't have much of a science background because I went to Brown where I could take wherever I wanted, and I wasn't very interested in science at the time, except for abstractly, but now I'm really interested in it. And so I can just, you know, I want to learn about fireflies, I want to learn about bees, I want to learn about global warming, I want to learn about whales, and there it is.
It's
and
all a tip. Yep.
That access, that unstoppable access is really, I think, allows for such tremendous possibility. And also just too much and
yes,
stupidity.
Can be overwhelm.
And stupidity and I think that one of the things there's a film that I'm going to show in my women's studies course called Misrepresentation, which is about the way that girls and women are represented in the media. And one of the points they make is that women and girls, the way that people learn about women and girls and sex and so on is at such a young age and so completely unmonitored, unregulated. There's no way to keep this stuff from people, and that there's a lot of distortion that goes on. And again, I don't think that we've figured out yet what this means and how we will contend with this.
Yeah, and a lot of what they see is filtered through a patriarchal culture, you know, historically.
Absolutely.
So that this is a problem. I'd love to have you read one of your poems as well, so we could talk about Facebook forever.
I know, we don't want to talk about
Internet.
Let's
hear one.
I have written about the media in some of my poems, but and this poem that we agreed that I would read does refer to the media, then I will read it. It's called You Pray to Rain Falling on the Desert. You pray to rain falling on the desert because it is a Sunday where the sky is blue nearly every day, and you might forget to be sad. Because you don't sing with a choir, except the quiet rain intoning on the backyard patio. And the raindrops outside are not the human voices you must listen to. Because in March, rains wake up desert flowers and globe mallow blooms everywhere, burning bushes in the valley of fire and vacant lots waiting for gas stations. You will see their orange blossoms flaring through your windshield, and no voice will say, I am. Because the rain will swell Lake Mead with our water for drinking, and bathtubs and gardens full of thirsty grass, roses, and oleander. Because the fatal bacteria will die in treatment plants. Because there are no mosquitoes here, no malaria. Because the children's hospital is stocked with medicine. Because the rain will wash away dust and misery and channel toxins from spent bombs into the groundwater. Because your daughter wanted to walk instead of drive, and she spun in her orange dress, pointed her pink sneakered foot, and curtsied in the driveway. Because rain on the desert is a multitude of tender hands applauding new life. It is the eve of war, and you don't believe the broadcast on radio and on television. I will rid you out of their bondage, and I will redeem you with a stretched out arm and great judgments. Because the rain keeps you inward, attending to the outward hiss of traffic on boulevards. Because the rain is unclear, a vast gray erasing demarcation. Because the rain makes you feel tired of the word because, tired of causes becoming effects, tired of causes, tired of tired reasons.
Beautiful. Beautiful poem. In this poem and in other poems, there's such a wonderful tightrope walk between light and dark. At least this is what I see. That it's kind of a very grounded and realistic optimism. It's not saying everything's wonderful because there are it is the eve of war, et cetera, and there are all these problems in life, and yet there's this orange sneakered foot, and your daughter hurts yeah. in the driveway. So there's this beautiful, visual, sensual light that comes through in so many yeah. of your poems. Would you
Thank
agree with
you.
That?
Yeah, I mean, I've written about the Holocaust. I've written about a lot of things that are horrifying. But I don't think that describing the horror in graphic ways, which is one of the things that has kind of driven me crazy about some of the stuff that's been out there in media recently, is that I had a Fulbright in Greece, and I was writing a sequence of poems about an imaginary, in the voice of an imaginary poet who survives the Holocaust, and she's a Sephardic Jew. So there was a lot of stuff going on, and at the same time that I was in Greece doing this research and writing these poems, the Greek government finally decided to put a few sentences about the Holocaust in Greece in the history books. And so they had a conference, which I attended, and there were people who were training the teachers and people like me how to teach the Holocaust. And one of the most memorable things was a woman who from Yad Vashem who said, don't show piles of dead bodies. Show pictures of people alive and teach the death through the life and the life through the death. Because people can't relate to something that has lost, that is a person who has become a thing. And I think it leads to objectification. Besides which, why bother to live if it's all bad? I mean, yes. really honestly.
Right.
The reason that it matters is because everyone is beautiful and wonderful, and I really do believe that. I believe that
yes.
even the worst of people, they have something inside them that can be redeemed. I know that's a very...
I agree, and they may have become horrible because of warping in childhood, et cetera, all kinds of things can warp the natural good
yeah.
open people.
And power and money and greed and all of that. But again, I return to the kind of small things that we do that matter, having a garden that attracts butterflies and bees, for example,
yes.
or being a teacher, you know, small things, just some kind of kindness. So I think that that's what comes through in my poems. In this particular poem, I mean, at least I hope so. In this particular
yes.
poem, I was living in Las Vegas at the time, and what that being in that place, being in the desert when there was about to be another war in the desert, allowed me to be two places at once and to speak of both places at once. And the interesting thing about the you know, the spent bombs, you know, going into the water, the groundwater, is that, you know, there were those atomic picnics where people would go up Mount Charleston and watch the atomic bombs go off. So
yeah.
there are spent bombs in the Las Vegas area. And one of the things that people don't talk about bombings is that it's an environmental catastrophe in addition, which has long-term effects on the people who live on that land, who survive on that land. It has long-term effects on their health and well-being, which matters.
Yes, of course. Yeah. And I know you mentioned plants in your garden that attract bees, and I know we have one more poem that you're going to read tonight that has a mention of bees, which is certainly important to the continuation of the world. Before we get to that, I had a question. I know that you edited Voices of Light, Spiritual and Visionary Poetry by Women from Ancient Sumeria to Now. And
right.
My question was, what did you look for in the poems that you were selecting? And this, I think, ties into what you're just saying about doing small acts of kindness or not having the dark overpower the light. What did you want the poems that you picked for that anthology to achieve, or I guess that's the question, or another question,
yeah.
How would you define poetry that's spiritual? What would that mean to you?
Well, in the introduction, I say that the spiritual is defined by a quest for union or union, and that can be very broadly defined. Many of the metaphysical poets and the religious poets, devotional poets, have very erotic poems, which are devotions to God, and then there are, or a Godhead or the universe. And so I looked for poems that I thought expressed in, because the book goes from ancient Sumeria to now, so there are a lot of cultures and a lot of languages. But I looked for poetry was first of all good, and second of all, transporting in some way. I don't know if that answers the question.
Yes,
but.
It does. Yes, it does. Thank you. Well, let's hear the poem "Alas" with the bees. I would love for you to share that with our listeners too.
Okay. I think this might be the first poem in the next book, but it might be the last poem in the next book, or it might be in the middle, but for now it's the first. Alas. All the days since the autumn equinox, I've been unable to get the word alas out of my mind. Alas, swirled on maple leaves burnished by rain. Alas, too pretty to be sad, though it signifies sadly. Alas, the birds alight too briefly before their southern leave. Alas, the lawn, monochrome emblem of the love of money, a single conforming species, its ranks, blades held aloft, poison-tipped, lethal, alas, to all insects except the few pests targeted. Lethal to little helpers and food progenitors. Alas, too many mistake for weeds and eradicate our wild violets and clover. I like the violet's heart-shaped leaves in my salad, shining with beads of oil. I like to think the soil likes the clover to fix its nitrogen, and the clover likes to be the grass Walt Whitman loves, inviting us to loaf and hum among wildflowers whose names recall daughters, home and harvest, pincushion, bachelor's button, and Queen Anne's lace, goldenrod cosmos and prairie aster, sweet alyssum, yarrow, and autumn joy, where bees intoxicated by nectar, not toxins, live to be our promiscuous pollinators.
Beautiful, beautiful. Thank you so much. I'm glad, Aliki, that you're sharing your many kindnesses and your concern for the world and your talent for writing with the world. I truly am.
Thank you, Donna.
Yeah. Do you know when your next book will be out?
No, I don't know when it will be out. I would not imagine it would be out until at the earliest 2016. I am just putting it together right now. In fact, my bed is spread with poems.
Yes.
I'm hopeful that it will be out in the next couple of years.
Yes, all right. And we have listed your other many publications on the Blog Talk Radio site and on the Tiferet Journal site. Would you also like to direct people to your own website so they can find out more about you and read more of your work, see your visual art as well?
My website is alikibarnstone.com. It's a little out of date, but there's still quite a lot on it. And then I also have alikibarnstone.blogspot.com, which is my blog, which I occasionally post on.
You're very prolific, and it's wonderful the way you switch between genres with such skill as well. So thank you, Aliki. And again, apologies for the technological snafu at the beginning here, but I have so enjoyed talking to you. I feel like we could talk. You have done so much. We could talk much longer than 30 minutes, but thank you.
Thank you.
For giving us this time tonight.
Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you, Aliki. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
I hope you've enjoyed tonight's Tiferet Talk. The show will be archived and available for later listening on our website at www.tiferetjournal.com. You're invited to join our global community of writers there and to subscribe to our literary magazine, Tiferet Journal. You can enjoy a generous 40% off summer discount if you subscribe by August 31st. Please join us at Tiferet Talk next month when we interview the author of Peaceful Warrior, Dan Millman, and his co-author daughter, Sierra Millman Prasada, on Wednesday, September 24th at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. In the meantime, all of us at Tiferet wish you and the world a meaningful and creative peace. May we all embody Tiferet in our lives, a loving heart, wise compassion, and an expansive reconciliation of opposites.